Hello, I'm Richard Kilgariff, and welcome to the Bokomi podcast. We're getting smarter, faster, together, with original memorable insights, or OMI, from the most wanted minds across business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode...
I'm Matthew Crawford, the author of Why We Drive, and this is my OMI for Bokomi.
Meet the philosopher mechanic who sees our freedom as drivers and citizens threatened by automation and bureaucracy.
Because what we're talking about is remaking the infrastructure, and not just of moving about, but of really kind of everything that goes on in a city, handing that over to a cartel of tech firms. And, you know, it's quite possible they will make the trains run on time, but at the cost of kind of political sovereignty over our collective life together.
Matthew Crawford's book, Why We Drive, on Freedom, Risk, and Taking Back Control, is a call to wheels, if you will, for anyone who has ever enjoyed the liberty of the open road and the fun of singing along to the radio in a traffic jam, which apparently is two-thirds of us. But like any excellent work of non-fiction, it takes laymen like me on a journey into the mind of an obsessive who loves his subject enough to share it with the world. Matthew, welcome to Bokomi.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I get the sense from spending some time with you in my head that you look at cars in the same way that I look at books, as manifestations of humanity written into the technology of the parts that make the engines hum? Or do you just like making things work and then driving them at speed?
Yeah, I like working. I mean, I've been working on cars since I was 15. I started working at a Porsche shop before I even had a driver's license. And I guess I've had a lifelong affection for driving, but not just driving, also riding motorcycles and skateboarding, riding bicycles. Somehow just the movement is a joy. And when you use a machine, even as something as a skateboard, to say nothing of a car, it kind of amplifies your natural kind of human mobility that just comes with your body. And you develop further skill sets that kind of further enhance that feeling of moving around. You know, we talk about the need for speed. I think that's a real thing.
Who said that originally? I've got the need for speed. I can't remember who
it was. I don't
know.
It's just a saying. I think it's almost a universal human thing. Like, I watched my daughter when she started riding a scooter down the hill, and then a pogo stick. You know what a pogo stick is? Do you have those?
We do, yeah. There? Yeah.
Yeah. And even just like a rope swing, so swinging under the tree, there's something about movement. It seems to be just part of our animal nature to want to move about.
And talking about movement, going back, way back to Aristotle, who defined humans as self-moving, what do you think we give up or gain even when we delegate movement, as you describe it, to say an onboard computer or satellite navigation?
Yeah, well, it's a matter of being a passenger, which is really quite different than moving under your, I wouldn't say under your own power, because obviously we're not talking about being a pedestrian in the case of driving, but you are directing yourself. And there's some very interesting research in developmental psychology about how when infants start moving on their own, crawling around, it's a very sort of decisive moment in development. And that's when they start developing a map of the world. And also it's when they start being able to remember episodes, sort of episodic memory. It's self-movement appears to be deeply implicated in the development of the hippocampus as part of the brain that is responsible for spatial reasoning. And it's interesting, cases where, for whatever reason, maybe a severe disability, the kid is not able to move in a self-directed way, there's a severe sort of impairment of that development. But if there have been cases where they give them like a little cart, various sort of technological enhancements for a disabled person, you then see this kind of spatial reasoning capacity develop. So it seems to be very important that we are self-directed in that way.
I love the combination that of memory and space, talking about memory and space. They're fascinating things to combine when you think about them. And I talked to a neuroscientist recently who specializes in memory or false memory. And she said that we're losing at the moment landmark memories in lockdown because we're not going to places as often as we were before. So time is speeding up and we literally don't remember where we've been.
Oh, that's interesting. There's also research showing that when you habitually rely on GPS, you're no longer mentally engaged in your own navigation, that you then fail to learn your surroundings. So especially if you're moving to a new place, and I just moved a year ago from Virginia to California. And, you know, so it's a confusing place to be. And so, of course, I rely on my map software on the phone initially, but after I've made a certain route, a certain trip, you know, once, I like to then not use it and just, you know, rely on my recall, because according to all the research, that is quite a significant factor in whether you really develop a map of the world.
Because, yeah, it's part of who we are, isn't it? And it also affects our sense of identity, where we are, and dependency, and our attitude to, I suppose, authority. Let's talk about driverless cars, if we can. I get the sense that, that for you, they don't represent a brighter, better, safer future, but they're just another attempt, as you put it, to monetize every moment of life. Why do you have that antipathy towards that particular technology?
Well, I mean, you know, Google is probably the biggest player in this space through their company Waymo. And what is Google? Well, it's the world's largest advertising company. So the question is, why are they getting into cars? And I think there's a couple of reasons. One is that your movements through space is some of the most valuable behavioral data about you. You can infer an awful lot about a person by their movements through the day. And so driverless cars, we have to assume, will be kind of hoovering up all this data and turning it to the purposes of surveillance capitalism, right? So this is the idea that this behavioral data becomes the basis for predictions about your behavior. And those predictions are then sold on a behavioral futures market. And this often happens in real time by whoever might want to sort of nudge you in one direction rather than another. And usually this is taking place beneath the threshold of awareness. So there's that. And then also, you know, you can imagine a future where maybe you could hail a driverless taxi and ride for free. This is one of the sort of scenarios that have been suggested. But of course, it's not really free because, you know, you get in the car and let's say you then have to decline a dozen offers tailored to your unique lifestyle before you get where you want to go. So, I mean, these are kind of obvious ways in which that thing we do of driving, say commuting, you know, that those are 20 minutes of undisturbed sort of private headspace that needs to be brought into the logic of capitalism. That appears to be the overriding concern, because there's money to be made there. And
well, I really like the way you unpick libertarianism in the book as something that, in terms of Silicon Valley at least, personifies the corporation rather than the individual. Can you expand a bit on that, as you were just then? And do you think that tech founders are well-meaning, or that they mean to take over people's lives?
Well, it's funny, the two can really coincide. I mean, there's a kind of messianic tech enthusiasm where I think a lot of people in Silicon Valley have drunk their own Kool-Aid and get sort of caught up in a vision of a new order. So, you know, the smart city is also part of the driverless car vision. You know, with sensors embedded through everything. And one guy was quoted as saying, you know, look at the cities we have. They're like the equivalent of flip phones, meaning that they're these sort of pathetic, you know, suboptimal things. And we need to sort of think them from scratch. That's the perennial kind of project of modernist social engineering. And it's, there's always some dream of order behind it. And it's interesting that, so there was this one incident where a Google car came up to an intersection and it was a four-way stop. So it stopped and it waited for the other cars to come to a complete stop before proceeding through. But of course, that's not what people do. And the Google car just got paralyzed because people, other people weren't following the rules and just kind of melted down there at the intersection. And what I found interesting is that the Google engineer in charge of this project, he said that what he had learned from it is that human beings need to be less idiotic. And of course, he meant by that, they need to behave more like robots. And that's an inference that I think comes quite easily if you regard the mind as basically an inferior version of a computer. But when I look at an urban intersection, I mean, it's, I mean, to take the example of the four-way stop, you know, there are often ambiguous cases of right of way. So people make eye contact. Maybe one person waves the other through. There's almost a body language of driving. And it's a little bit messy, but for the most part, it works just fine. There's an improvisational character to it. And what you're seeing is people cooperating, which is, I think, a really core element of democratic political culture.
Because around the world, different traffic systems represent different cultures and the way people see driving changes, doesn't it? You talk about Italy, you talk about London, it almost has a religious significance. You talk about Pope Francis on New Year's Eve in 2018 through his homily at St. Peter's, praising drivers who move, and I quote, with good sense and prudence. And it's as if the way that they drive expresses their love for each other and the city. And you say some of the best urban drivers you've seen are in London. Why is that?
Well, what impresses me about London is drivers don't seem to be overly rule-bound, which, you know, you might say leads to chaos, and I suppose it probably does sometimes, but it seems like drivers are prizing flow over rule following. So sort of opportunities seized and, you know, occasional moments of deference. It's almost like a dance. And it's extremely efficient compared to just strict rule following. So it's that improvisational character, again, that I think is significant. And one thing that's emerged in some recent cognitive science is that the human mind is fundamentally organized for making predictions, and in particular, mutual predictions of one another's behavior. We're extremely sensitive in sort of reading the cues. So there's this kind of social intelligence on display. Or take Rome as another example, a Roman intersection, which to an American looks like chaos. It looks horrifying. But again, there's collective solving of a problem. And it's insofar as driverless cars are promising to relieve us of, you know, traffic congestion and accidents, to some degree, it looks like solving a problem that's already been solved pretty well by human drivers. And the prospects of the robots doing it better, I mean, theoretically, that's possible, but it's really quite, it's turned out to be a far harder engineering challenge than they first thought, or even thought just a couple of years ago. So that is an oddly gratuitous character to the project once you appreciate how much human intelligence is a very adaptable thing.
And what's interesting is you couple human intelligence and humanity with the technology of the car and the internal combustion engine, which you refer to as a miracle. But there was a time in society where the engine and the machine, and in particular the Ford Motor Company, for instance, were seen as the enemies of humanity, and the mechanization of humanity incarnate, just like maybe you're seeing machine intelligences now. Do you draw that comparison too, or do you think it's different now?
Well, yeah, 100 years ago, you know, it was the Ford Motor Company that came up with the assembly line, or, you know, scaled it up to a level it hadn't been before. And this is, you know, the moment in the history of capitalism when we had a separation of thinking from doing. So the whole point was to replace skilled workers with people who are just, you know, pulling levers on an assembly line. And of course, the point of that is to reduce labor costs. So the genuine knowledge work gets concentrated in a much smaller elite. So that logic of separating thinking from doing has extended into all areas of the economy, really. So white collar workers too find that many of them are reduced to clerks, essentially, and the genuine knowledge work takes place in a smaller sort of managerial group.
Do you think that you are you're putting yourself in the way of criticism for hankering after a bygone era? I know that you collect and build and restore cars and bikes and trailers. And are you longing for a world that's been before, or do you think that human beings and collective intelligence is still embodied in the motor vehicle?
Well, I don't think it's hankering after the past or clinging to something that's dying. It's more like a recognition that what currently exists is pretty adequate, and looking with a fairly jaundiced eye at the sort of transformative vision that's being sort of pressed upon us, and seeing that one thing it would entail is a kind of monopoly on the means of getting about. Basically, we're talking about turning transportation into a platform in the same sense of, you know, the social media platforms, the search platforms. It's a kind of winner-take-all economy. That's just the nature of it. One thing to worry about is that we wouldn't have any sort of a democratic control over it, because what we're talking about is remaking the infrastructure, not just of moving about, but of really kind of everything that goes on in a city, handing that over to a cartel of tech firms. And, you know, it's quite possible they will make the trains run on time, but at the cost of a kind of political sovereignty over our collective life together.
And I wonder, let's say the future does become driverless or more driverless, and there are lots of driverless cars zipping about the highways and byways of the world. Road rage could still be in existence in a slightly different way. Maybe we've got more time to be angry, but I don't think road rage will be the same in the future if we don't get to drive ourselves. You've got some brilliant expressions that you've collected in the book, in the section on road rage. One in particular springs to mind from Bulgaria and translates as, "May you build a house from your kidney stones." There's some other good ones. "That's my nuts on your car," when somebody has just put their nuts on their car. "Christ on a bendy bus," that's a British one. "Christ on a bendy bus."
Have you heard that, or is that, does somebody make that up? I'm just reporting. I just reported the news here.
Someone will have said that. I mean, there are variations on the "Christ on a bendy bus," and there's "You're as dense as Fat Pat's arteries." That's a reference to a soap opera called EastEnders. I think you've just been hanging out in a very, cussy crowd.
Well, that's certainly true.
Anyway, really, the essence of the book is encapsulated in this phrase of yours, I think, is to drive is to exercise one's skill at being free. What lengths do you think we should go to in this age of disruption and protest to protect this skill at being free, this freedom, without smashing up computers and running red lights? What lengths do you think we should go to? Is it as important as civil liberties?
Well, let me first try to say a little about what I take to be at stake here. And I open the book with a scene that is not at all typical of the driving we do every day. But it's this vignette where I'm riding a dirt bike on a trail, and through the woods, and there's mud, there's rocks, there's roots, there's steep descents, there's creek crossings, all this stuff that's coming at you fast, even if you're only going, say, 15 miles an hour. And when I'm doing that, if I push the pace beyond my current abilities and it goes well, I feel elated. I feel somehow enlarged by that. But of course, often it doesn't go well and I crash. And I once had four trips to the emergency room in the course of 12 months in the pursuit of that feeling. So I think the hunch that I started with that really animated the book was that risk is bound up with important human possibilities. And that cuts very much against what I call the ideology of safetyism. And this seemed worth pursuing at this moment because with driverless cars, I take that to be one instance in a wider shift in our relationship to the material world, in which the demands of competence give way to a promise of safety and convenience. And trust me, this is going to circle around back to your political point eventually. This project of kind of disburdening ourselves of the tasks of living, usually it points to the least competent among us to justify the project. And, you know, that is an egalitarian principle that is, I think, entirely fitting in many settings. But also, if you don't push back against that, I think it leads to an unrealistically low view of human capacities. And there's a kind of infantilization that creeps in under cover of our democratic ideals. But my sense is that, in fact, democracy only remains viable if we're willing to extend to one another a presumption of individual competence. And that's because I think that is the basis for social trust. It's the basis for precisely what you're witnessing in that Roman intersection, where people are trusting one another to abide by certain norms, to be alert, to be able to temper their impatience, to be able to keep their attention directed to the road. It's a case of self-governance in the individual sense, or self-command in that sense, that, you know, is the condition for self-governance in a political sense. So my sense is that the automation imperative, one way to think about it is that it's a response to declining social trust, where we're trying to replace that improvisational living together and cooperation with a kind of machine-generated certainty, render moot all those sort of character traits of the democratic personality. And that's a little disturbing.
So you make the reference to film, film Wall-E in the book as well, which is interesting, because when you were describing the cognitive impotence of human beings and the implied effect that social science and nudges have on our behavior, I thought of the characters and the passengers in the spaceship in Wall-E, who have all given up trying or doing anything and are just fed and watered. Yeah. And then you refer to it in the book. And I thought that was very interesting, because we both had the same thought of the same time, the same sort of people as an example of that. But where you are now in the Bay Area of the States, isn't the whole way of life to be quite laid back and not to engage unless you have to engage?
I'm wondering what kind of image of of California exists in across the pond. Well, yeah, the movie Wall-E, I guess what you're seeing is, so for anyone who hasn't seen the film, they're hovering about in these pods, sort of driverless pods, slurping from enormous cup holders, gazing raptly at their screens where sort of novelties are piped in from afar, presumably some kind of entertainment. And so these are beings that are completely safe and content and somehow less than human. So, and I think you can't see that scene without feeling a kind of revulsion. And I take that as a kind of emotional cue that there's something amiss in that picture. So then the question is to try to kind of worry it apart. and figure out why it's revolting. And I think it's, you know, it's a picture of passivity and dependence and living in a world where skill is obsolete. There's no point in having skill. And, you know, it would be to put complete faith and trust in some apparatus that is governing you. And that would be to give up on the original insight of liberalism. I'm talking about way back the English Revolution. The insight was that power corrupts, and therefore you want to sort of disseminate power. You want to spread it around, distribute it. And I think at bottom, if you have faith in the intelligence of ordinary people and their capacity to solve problems together, then you have to really second guess these projects of centralization, because that's what we're talking about.
Well, Matthew, you've certainly engaged the gearbox of my brain through your book and through the time you spent with us today. Thank you so much for sharing your OMI with Bukomi, and keep driving and keep finding the spaces that you want to find.
Well, thanks for doing this. It was really quite a good conversation. And I'm sorry for those chimes. I don't know how to turn them off. It's coming from my computer.
Bloody hippies. I thought it was hippies living next door.
There are zero hippies in the Bay Area at this point. They've all been chased out by exorbitant rents.
Of course. Matthew Crawford's book, Why We Drive, On Freedom, Risk, and Taking Back Control, is available now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. And if you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, sign up to our monthly Most Wanted email at bukomi.com. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bukomi podcast, please reveal your feelings by liking, following, or subscribing on Apple, Spotify, and Google audio platforms, or any other platform as many exist. I'm Richard Kilgariff. Drive good, drive smart, be kind to each other on the road. Bye for now.